Bonjour à tous et à toutes. Bienvenue à cette nouvelle rencontre du 9e type. Je m'appelle Raymond Poirier. J'anime l'émission La vie en BD sur CKRL 89.1. Et c'est un plaisir, évidemment, de vous retrouver à nouveau pour une rencontre, pour une entrevue détaillée, comme on vous propose déjà depuis quelques semaines, donc à La vie en BD et avec la collaboration, évidemment, de Québec BD. Je vous rappelle, les rencontres du 9e type, qu'est-ce que c'est? Bien, c'est très simple, c'est des rencontres en profondeur, en détail, des longues entrevues qu'on réalise avec des auteurs et des autrices du Québec, d'Amérique du Nord et d'Europe. Et pour cette semaine, la dernière d'ailleurs rencontre avant la pause estivale, on se retrouvera évidemment en septembre prochain, mais donc pour cette dernière rencontre avant la pause estivale, eh bien, on va du côté des États-Unis, plus précisément du côté de l'Ohio, pour aller à la rencontre de Derf Bagderf. Derf Bagderf, donc un auteur qui a offert plusieurs albums au fil des dernières années, des albums qui ont été fort appréciés. Je pense notamment à son « Mon ami Damer ». Il y a également « Punk Rock et Mobile Homes », la version française de « Punk Rock et Trailer Parks ». Il y a « Trashed » également, donc une bande dessinée qui s'intéresse à la gestion des déchets, de la gestion des matières résiduelles du point de vue du travailleur. Et prochainement, dans le fond, un album qui s'en vient qui s'appelle « Kent State, 4 morts dans l'Ohio », donc son plus récent album dont la sortie a été retardée à la faveur justement de cette pandémie de COVID-19. Alors, c'est les albums qui seront un peu à l'ordre du jour et évidemment le parcours de Derf Bagderf dans cette rencontre du 9e type. Derf Bagderf, thank you very much for agreeing to this interview and welcome to the show.
My pleasure.
Et évidemment, l'entrevue va se faire en langue anglaise au fil de l'heure. Derf, you've always been known to draw, but we need to go back to yourself at 10 years old, as you became fascinated with comic books and that you started to think about comics as a means to tell a story instead of just drawing.
Yeah, sure, yeah, very early. I don't know why, you know. It was actually probably even earlier than that. It was more like 7 or 8 years old. I think comics authors are born. They're not really, you have no choice but to be a comics author, you know?
Yeah, at the time you see, you want to draw and you see the possibility and eventually you explore it to the medium itself and the way it lends to a variety of topics. And you actually went before graphic novels were in journalism. You were a political cartoonist for quite a while.
I was, also. Yeah. Well, not that long, but I did it in college. Well, I have political cartoons I drew when I was 10 years old, believe it or not. And I have one about Kent State, which, you know, is my new book that I actually drew when I was 10, when the shootings happened. It's crazy. So I don't know why. And I started doing political cartoons in college for a newspaper. You know, the college had a newspaper, and I did cartoons for them. Jeff Smith was doing his comic strip at the same time, Bone, in the same paper. So okay. It was kind of, it was this real, you know, pool of talent. And but I didn't stick with political cartoons for long. I got kind of bored with it. I also got fired.
Yeah, I've seen somewhere that you were fired a couple of times, once for general tastelessness.
Yeah, that was for the political cartoons, yeah. So I thought, well, maybe I'll try something else. And that's when I started doing a comic strip.
Yeah, and with The City, you kind of exploded. Mm-hmm. At the time, it was about like 140 medias that were publishing
right.
it.
Right, so that's right, yeah. Yeah, it was a lot of fun. You know, this was in the 1990s. So there were a lot of the big American authors started with comic strips, these types of comic strips. Chris Ware, Charles Burns, Matt Groening, of course. Who else? Alison Bechdel. She started out there. So, I mean, there was a whole bunch of us that were doing this. And it was a lot of freedom and it was a lot of fun. And that lasted about 10 years, and then that was over. So then I started doing books.
Yeah, you kind of managed to bail at the right time because
the
industry was kind of fading, and you were already moving on to the next thing.
Right, right. I was already moving on to books. And, you know, that's it turns out, much to my surprise, I'm better at books than I am at anything else, which means I wasted 25 years of my career. But, you know, that's the way it goes. I'm happy to be doing it now. So it worked out okay.
And how was the transition between short form comics and graphic novels? Because I guess getting used to share a story, right, a short one, and then you go to about like 50, 30, 100 page and stuff like this.
Yeah. It was a little tougher than I expected, because, you know, it's, as you say, it's very different. You have to have all these characters. You have to tie everything together. You have to keep track of this long plot and all these little subplots and tie. I mean, it's very, and the drawing is much more complicated. You know, with a comic strip, you don't have to. I mean, you can, but you don't have to draw really, really detailed backgrounds and all this stuff. And with books, you have to do that. But I found I really enjoyed it. So once I got going, it's okay. I mean, it's always a challenge. You know, books are not easy to do, but you know, it's something I feel very good about now. Yeah, I don't think I could draw a comic strip anymore. Honestly, I couldn't do it. So I've forgotten now. So it's books or nothing.
Yeah, and the experience that you got, like drawing, learning about the work, also with the political cartoons and then the city, I guess it serves you, because you managed to define a bit your style, and then afterward you needed to adapt it to,
right,
long form.
You do. That's right. Yeah, I mean, if you look at those different periods, it looks like three different artists, really. But, you know, you have to change to suit the story that you're working on. So, you know, I had this really crazy, when I was doing the strip, I had this really crazy cartoon style. It just was, I mean, it wouldn't be appropriate for, say, Mon Ami Dahmer or Kent State. You know, it just, it would look stupid. So you have to change to suit the story. And that's the important thing.
And I guess that's with punk rock and trailer parks that you like solidified this style that you worked on before. And that,
right,
was the first time that we saw a graphic novel version of Derf by Derf.
Yeah, well, I had a couple short stories earlier. I started doing short stories probably 96 or 97, right around in there.
Yeah, with Mon Ami Dahmer, actually.
I did. Yeah, I did some Dahmer stories. Yeah, and I did some trash stories as well. So, you know, I was trying to figure this stuff out, but it took about 10 years to really develop a style that I was comfortable with. Yeah.
Yeah. And you manage, I guess if we compare, like we talk about trash, but both versions of the one before, the one from 1990s and the one that was published in Europe and French versions and stuff like this, it's two different things. I'd see that the first one is shorter. It's more like intense, more written.
Yeah.
Take a bit more of your time with the second version.
It kind of reads like a long comic strip, you know, because I didn't know how to change the pace. You know what I mean? Because I was only used to those four panels. So I guess I was like, you know, pow, 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 and you're done. And I had more room now, but I couldn't figure out how to make it, slow it down and then speed it up. And that's what was the hardest thing to do, to just learn how to slow down. And even punk rock is very, I mean, it is really fast paced, which is okay because so is the music. But, it wasn't until Mon Ami Dahmer that I figured out how to really, you know, really slow down and like linger over a scene. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that was like what, 12 years.
And I guess with punk rock also came after a period where health was in question. So it was, if we talk a bit about this album, like it's full of joy, I think. And I guess that coming from where you're coming from, it was something that was needed at that time.
Right, yeah. Yeah, I had cancer for a while in the 2000s. So, yeah, that was kind of what I used to recover from my illness. And Yeah, I that's why I put aside, one of the reasons I stopped working on Mon Ami Dahmer. It's just like, oh, I don't want to deal with this right now. So I'll do this really fun story about this crazy character. And yeah, as you say, it is a joyful story. Yeah, that's absolutely right.
And it's a story, if we set it a bit for those who haven't read it and should read it. So you cover actually the punk rock music scene of Akron at a time. The scene was mostly like Cleveland, Detroit, and Akron. That was the triangle of punk rock. And
right.
Everybody came to Akron actually at that time.
Yeah, it was a unique time. It only lasted for about 4 or 5 years, but it was really incredible. And it was fun to, you know, recreate this factory town, which is now just absolutely devastated. You know, it's empty and all the buildings are boarded up. And to show that happening, you know, that they kind of capitalist, you know, craziness where we just let things die. And so I worked all that. There's a little bit of politics in that book too, you know, very much so. Yeah. But and that music scene, I mean, most people have forgotten it if they even knew about it in the first place. So it's really fun documenting that and telling people about something that is kind of forgotten.
And something that you experience firsthand in a way, because there's some truth that gives way to the story, concerts that you've been, thing that you've lived, and there's a big part that's fiction with Otto, and the whole story itself is fiction, but based in a reality that you experienced.
Oh, sure, yeah. All of the concert scenes that I show in the book are concerts that I went to and are very, very truthful. So, you know, you write about what you experience, even if it's fiction, and that gives your work a bit of truth, you know, and I think readers respond to that.
And I guess it was easier or funnier or better to like go back for yourself at that time, to go back to those experiences and infuse yourself with them to give the levity to the album itself.
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, I think that Otto himself, I mean, once I came up with Otto, who's not a real person, he's the hero of the book. I found that, you know, if I just put Otto in a scene, the scene writes itself based on what Otto would do. You know, it's kind of magic. And so a lot of the book was written that way. It's like, what would Otto do if I put him here? And, you know, there it is. There's the scene. So that was a lot of fun, actually.
So you had to find the character. Was it a lot of work to find this guy, this inspiration, or
you know, he just kind of dropped from the sky. I don't know where he came from, but it was one day. I completely wrote Otto. I just started writing. You know, I started drawing him, and then I just started writing his personality, and I'm like, wow, this is it. I mean, this is the guy. I don't know where. He was magic. I don't know where he came from. I'm very grateful.
It was kind of the antithesis of yourself also, in a way.
Yeah.
Very outgoing. Yeah. And
Right. Yeah, I was, I was just a comic book nerd. I was very, very quiet and very, very shy.
And I guess with the punk rock, the story itself is kind of like a coming of age story for this guy, for Otto,
trying to find
a sense of belonging.
Right. Yeah, that's the important thing. You know, it's about those types of scenes. We call it the counterculture here. I don't know what the French word is, but you know, when you don't fit in anywhere else, when you're an outcast, when you're a freak. And you find a scene like punk rock, as all of them did. I mean, look at the Ramones. They were all insane. And suddenly you find your community, you know, you find your group of people. And it's a magic thing when that happens. So, yeah, that's what I was trying to do. I was definitely trying to show that.
Yeah, and show a character that's kind of like the guy never gives up. The life is hard for him. He's poor. He has a faded band. He fails at just about everything, but he never gives up.
He's a total failure. Yeah, he is. But he keeps going. You know, that's Otto, and that's why you say it's hopeful.
Yeah, in this kind of characters, like in French, we will say plus grande nature in a way, or like very outgoing, eccentric. It's a kind of character that comes and goes in all of your books in a way.
Yeah, a little bit.
McGee and Trash is kind of like that also.
Oh, very much so, yeah. Yeah. McGee and Trash. I don't know. Yeah. I'm actually thinking about doing another book with McGee, so we'll see about that. He was a lot of fun, too. I mean, you know, my fictional books, I've always managed to come up with some really good characters. So I enjoy writing fiction, but I also like nonfiction as well. But, you know, you have more fun with fiction.
It's neat to, go from one to the other. You did the Punk Rock and Mobile Homes, then Bammer, then Trash to the second one, then Kent State. So it feels to me like a deep, like hard research stuff, and then a bit something with more levity in a way.
Yes, well, I have to recover from the deep, hard research stuff. Like Kent State took me 4 years, you know, and Mon Ami Dahmer took me, it took about 20 years. So it's really intense, and, you know, you need a break.
Yeah, and I guess is the work organized the same way? Because you said, like with Punk Rock, the character just came, and then you put it in a situation and goes organically in a way. So is the same way with Trash when compared with Mon Ami Dahmer or with Kent State, that you need to like be more precise, more organized, and with those you can just go with the flow and see what's coming?
Right, that's exactly right. I mean, I had certain, you know, you figure out a plot, you know, you figure out where the story starts and where it ends, and then everything in between is what the characters kind of create on their own. And I had a lot of good characters in Trash, so I had some stuff I wanted to talk about because it is, you know, sort of autobiographical, even though it's not really. And that was a really easy book to write. That one just was just like that. I mean, I probably wrote it in maybe 2 weeks. But then I had to do some research because Trash has research in it as well, and that took a little longer. But the actual story was very easy to write, just like Punk Rock.
Yeah, you go back to your youth. You go to it was a job that you had at around 19 years old, so you can go from your experience, from the anecdotes of coworkers, and just create, as with Punk Rock, that you take something you know and you create something around it.
Yep, that's exactly right. Yeah, you just kind of twist it and mix it around. And the nice thing about fiction is it doesn't have to be true. You know, you can make stuff up to make a better story. But it still has that bit of truth because, you know, you lived it. So I really like working that way.
Yeah, and I guess as a reader that we feel that this weight, like this base of truth, and it gets us, I guess, to immerse in an easier way in the story because we can accept the truth that's there and have fun with the fiction that's there.
Right, also. I hope so. Yeah, that's what I hope. It's good to hear.
And with Trash, as we say, the first one was more of a memoir. It was run in like 1997, 1998. The second one you wrote after Dahmer. And it's kind of like a story that we don't really tell, the story of the garbage man. Like it's, I guess it's you seek to find like angles or stories that haven't been told yet, or
that's
ways
right,
that
yeah.
haven't been told.
Yeah, that's fun, you know, because it's new and it's fresh, and people are surprised. I think when people read Trash, they're very surprised at, you know, what we do with our garbage, because it's not something we think about. But, you know, walk around, you know, any city on garbage day and you wonder, where does all this stuff go? You know, I mean, walk around Paris on garbage day. I mean, it's just, you're just piles of it, you know, and then it's gone. And it's like, okay, that problem's solved. Well, not really. Not really.
Yeah, it's kind of two tales in a way, like the daily routine full of colorful characters, funny anecdotes. Mm-hmm. And then there's the critic of U.S. and everywhere's political and economical system of like a portrait of a country's waste management and our failure with it, also with all the plastic and all the garbage that is generated.
It's, right. And, you know, the scary thing is that book was published in 2016 and it's already horribly out of date. It's gotten much worse. Because the recycling industry has collapsed, and so all of that recyclables, they're going straight into the landfill or straight into the incinerator or wherever they're going, and it's a nightmare right now. Yeah, and the pandemic's only making it worse. So you know, it's that book is already out of date.
It gives us an alarm, and if you wrote it right now, it will be a worse alarm than you gave us.
Yeah, it would be. Absolutely. I just read something the other day that scientists in the Arctic found plastic, like those little plastic pellets, they're called microplastic. It's what they make plastic out of. And when plastic breaks down in the ocean, it breaks back down into these little tiny pellets. And they found them at the North Pole. They're everywhere. And then you think about, well, plastic's only been around for maybe 70 years, and we filled the world with plastic in 70 years. That's really depressing.
that's a monumental waste.
Yeah,
plastic is, and it's kind of like I guess putting an album like this together. You first wrote it and you rewrote it afterward. Mm-hmm. I guess as we said, it was the rhythm you find more you groove after a few albums. So it needed to show where you were instead of where you were before, like Dammer and punk rock. So I have a more mature view of that story in a way.
Oh sure, yeah, and it's also set in. It's not, you know, from when I was young. It's supposed to take place in 2016. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, it's a modern story, because what's the point of writing something like that that's, you know, 30 years old? It doesn't make any sense. So yeah, it changed it. It was fun. Yeah, it was fun. I could have made that book longer. I mean, I just went on and on with it. It was, I really enjoyed it.
It's hard to go back to original material and like not judge too much what you did, or just try to take away. How was the rewriting or retelling process?
It was actually pretty easy. You know, I mean, I had a different goal. So, you know, the original one was just my experience. And I think that'll probably be published in French, actually, as we're talking about it. Just those little original stories, just for fun. They're very different than the finished book, the larger album. But when I went back, you know, I mean, the drawing was so primitive. I was really happy to redo the drawing. And, it was not hard. I'd already done it with Mon Ami Dammer, so, because I went through the same... Mon Ami Dammer, I rewrote like, you know, three or four times before I finally produced the finished album. So it's something that you don't want to waste a good story, you know? I mean, you keep working on it till you get it right. And then finally, when you do, you can go, okay, I'm done with that one. Move on to the next one. I didn't want to waste that story.
Kind of with Dammer, as you said, there was like a 24-page version, there were short stories, there was a 100-page one, and then the main one that we've seen edited. So you saw the potential in that story, but I guess you had to find at first a way for you to tell it, and secondly, someone also to publish it,
which
was quite hard.
I had a lot of trouble finding a publisher, yeah, I know. It seems it's amazing now, but no, it was turned down by every publisher in the U.S. at one point or another, every comics publisher, yeah. And which I take great pleasure in reminding them of today. But back then, it just kept getting rejection after rejection. And finally, I found one, but it took a long time, yeah.
And we can talk a bit about Dammer before going into Kent State also. Mm-hmm. We talked a bit about your fiction book, with basis in truth. Now we can go to the non-fiction ones. And Dahmer right. is kind of like, it's a bit like, it's a different beast than Kent State. Kent State, for me, it's more like a journalistic work. And Dahmer is more like a kind of a testimony from your perspective.
Right.
What happened.
Right. Yeah. So. Yeah, Dahmer is, it's a combination of journalism and memoir, which is kind of unusual. But that was really the only way to tell that story. So I did the best I could with it. But yeah, there was a lot of research. I interviewed a lot of people. I, you know, went over police records and FBI reports and just all of this stuff. A huge amount of material. I have a whole file cabinet full of it. And then added that to my own memories and memoir and tried to tie them together. That was Mona Lee Dahmer. Kent State is just purely research, so it's a different, that's a different, because I, that's not memoir, I wasn't there, but so that's a different type of album. But
yeah, and Kent State is like the amount of things that you had to read or see. There's like the trial stuff, there's two films in Yale and one in Kent. There's like 140 oral histories. You did interviews also. So it's like, when you say 4 years of work, it's 4 years of work and research.
Yeah, 4 years. Yeah. Yeah. It was probably, well, you know, I was still researching it as I was drawing the last page. I mean, so yeah, it was four solid years of research, and I would change panels, you know, if I got an interview, say, with someone I'd been trying to track down for a couple of years, and finally I managed to talk to them, and I was like, oh shit, I gotta change this panel. So I, you know, I'd go back and redraw it. It was, that's another book. I just could have kept going with that book. I wish I had had another year to work on it. Turns out I did have another year, but who knew that at the time? Because, you know, I found stuff, I have stuff that I discovered after I turned the book in that I would have put in the book. So it's kind of frustrating.
And to recall, I think Kent State, for those who don't remember, it's set in the 1970. So it's like a manifestation, a protest for the war in Vietnam. And there were four kids killed in those protests. And it shocked
soldiers.
It shocked America by soldiers, yeah.
Well, they were killed by soldiers, yeah. So it was the first time in many years that the government actually turned its guns on its own citizens because they were protesting. So, and now, you know, you look out the window at what's happening now, and it's, it was always meant, you know, I always felt, okay, this is going to be a very cautionary tale, you know, because I thought 2020 was going to be bad. I didn't know how bad, but and then this whole thing exploded, and of course the book is sitting in warehouses because of the pandemic, which is just torture. So it'll be out in September, and I hope you know, the whole world hasn't exploded by then, but it's certainly very, very relevant. And you know, I mean, the protests have been going on in France for some time now. So there's always been interest there, and it's the same thing. You know, the police just keep getting a little more brutal. They get more and more frustrated when people won't stop protesting, and it could be tragedy. It was in 1970, so that's the story. But it's this very personal story about these four kids, because I tell it from their point of view. So it's a very emotional story, and one that was always important to me. So I'm very proud of the book. I don't know. Oh, here's the, I don't know if you've seen the final, there it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
With the
stick.
And it was, as we said, some stuff that was already documented. Also, there was some books, there were other stuff around that. And in keeping with the theme that stories that weren't told, you decided to actually go and focus on these four kids and tell it from their point of view, because that hadn't been told yet.
Right, right. And I talked to a lot of their friends and their family. So I tried to get to know these kids and take an angle that no one else had done. And hopefully I pulled it off. I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah, well,
I didn't mean to skip right over Mon Ami Dahmer. I know you.
Oh no, it's okay. I follow you on that, and it's something that we can touch a lot of thing about that because kind of like with Dahmer also, there's powerful imagery related to these protests. I have in mind the Marianne Vecchio kneeling over Jeffrey Miller, and it's an image that went all around. And
right.
I guess as an author, and to put it in the medium, you need to capture the terror, and the scream actually in the comic goes about like three pages.
I focused on the scream, because my thinking there was that that's the one thing you don't get in the photo. You know, the photo is this very famous, world famous photo, one of the great photos of the 20th century. So what's the point of just, you know, recreating that photo? But what we don't have is the scream. And you can do that in comics. You can add that scream into comics. So that's really what carries that scene. And that's I don't know if it works or not, but that's what I decided to try. I'll be happy to see this book finally released. Yeah.
And we'll be happy to read it on paper instead of on the computer and stuff.
Oh, like right. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
And it's in a way, it's kind of like you need to depict shock and horror in that time, because the whole structure of the protest is like, we've got the during the day it intensify, it's like a crescendo, and there are explosions, and then it falls and start again the next day, but always more tense.
Right, exactly. That's exactly right. Yeah, it takes place over 4 days. The protest started on a Friday, and then there was Saturday, and then Sunday, and then Monday was when the shootings occurred. And each day it got a little worse. And after the shootings, the whole country exploded. I mean, every college in the United States, something like 450 colleges had to close down because of protests. They just stopped the school year. Well, sort of like what we're doing now, but for a different reason. And it just, the whole country just stopped. People tell me it was worse than 2020, what we're experiencing now, that era, but it's hard to believe. You know, I don't really remember it because I was just a little kid. I remember some of it, but not like this, you know, not like now where you're an adult, you have some experience and you know what's happening. So you can see the changes. I mean, in 1970, there was a Vietnam War, and that was horrible, but there had always been a Vietnam War as far as I was concerned. I don't remember a time when there wasn't. And there were protests, but there had always been protests, right? So for me, it was just normal. It's weird, but I mean, that had been my life at that point. But now it's a little more scary.
Yeah. And I guess at the time, though, when you actually have the army in your hometown, then you guess something is changing, something is intensifying in a way.
Sure, yeah. The soldiers were first sent to my hometown, which was this little tiny town outside of Akron, very much like the town in punk rock and Mobile Homes. And there was a union strike. Some truck drivers went on strike, and they sent in the soldiers to kind of beat them into submission. And so they had occupied my hometown, and it was terribly disturbing. I mean, I have photos of, you know, the soldiers lining the streets of my hometown with their bayonets out. It's crazy. And that's what really has always made this story important to me, because those same soldiers then went to Kent State, and they're the ones that opened fire. So I've always had like this connection to this story. When I realized that, it was very shocking. Even at a young age, I thought, wow, you know, it's just one of those. I mean, that's how events in history affect people, right? You know, you have that little personal connection, and that's enough to really make it solid in your mind.
And you decided to open with it in the first 10 pages.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I just wanted to like establish my connection. That's it. It's not much of a connection. I mean, I have friends who were there. You know, I have a friend who was in that parking lot with bullets whizzing over his head. So, there are people who have a much greater connection than I do, but I still do have a connection. And that's how history works. That's how it works.
Yeah, and the ripple effect, and it awakes something. It gets you interested into politics, sure. And then eventually to cartoons, eventually to
right,
and it all comes back to the book.
Yeah, it did. Yeah, and here I am again on Kent State.
And how I talked a bit about the overwhelming amount of information. So how, as an auteur, you not get overwhelmed by everything, by all of that, and you manage to actually organize all of that into like a 300 pages book?
Right. Well, you have to be very organized. Yeah, I learned that in journalism school, how to organize a story and get all my, and then it's the process as a writer of figuring out what's important and what's not important, and kind of building the story and tying it together. So it's like a puzzle. I think it's fun. I mean, there's a lot of things I didn't know. So researching like some of the radical groups in the United States at the time, I didn't know a lot about them. And that was really interesting because that's another history that hasn't really been told. And, what all the things the FBI and the CIA were up to, it was shocking. And so, my journalism training really, that's something that is just very enjoyable to find these things and then, put them in the story.
Yeah, as long as you found the focus, which were the kids, and then afterward you say, okay, that's my my main road, and then I can put some branches there, here and there to like
that's
amplify.
Exactly right. Yeah, you always have to be focused on, you have, when you first sit down to write a book, any book, you have to decide, okay, what's my book about, and once you decide that, then you have to really stick to that, and you can't lose track of that. And with Kent State, it was always, I'm going to show this story through the eyes of these four kids. And we see everything they see, and we experience what they experience right up to the end. And you can't, there are other things that happen that is like, well, but yeah, none of my four kids were there, so I'm not going to include that. I'll maybe write it in a caption, but I won't include that scene. So you really have to be true to your original vision.
And in a way also, there's a harder thing that you needed to do as far as if I put myself in your shoes, in the fact that most of the stuff happened at night. There are night photography and night wasn't all as good as it is now back then. Mm-hmm. So there weren't that much pictures of actually what happened.
Not at night, no. The night scenes were, there's not a lot of photos. And the other problem was that the soldiers were running around beating everybody. So if you were a photographer, you were going to get gassed, you were going to get beaten and arrested, and your camera would be smashed, and that was the end of it. So yeah, there wasn't a lot. So I had to actually create those images based on personal accounts, what people said happened, and some photo reference of the scene during the day. It's like, okay, this is the building where that happened. I have the photo. Now I'll just I'll draw it at night. And, that's what comics can do. I mean, that's what this art form can do. We can create those images and make a narrative and make a scene. And I think it worked. I think the night scenes actually are the best scenes in the book. So.
And I guess you take one scene and you make sure that to corroborate it to like two accounts and testimonies and stuff like this.
At least two. Yeah, at least two. Three is better. But two is, that's what I was taught in journalism school as well. You can't just go with one source. Sometimes you have to because there is only one source. But you really have to try to get more than one.
So at times you needed like when you did the scenario, there was like, okay, I've got my three sources for this scene. But this one, I still need to research it more to make sure. Like a list or something?
Yeah. I would know. Yeah, I would make notes, find another source for this. It was tough. It took a long time, like I said.
Yeah, and it came about like the topic itself, it's, as we said, it's linked a bit to your experience, but actually it was for the, I think, 30th anniversary of the... 50th anniversary of the event that you actually decided or felt that it would be a good story to tell.
Yeah, it would have been, wouldn't it? But then the pandemic hit, and
yeah,
the 50th was anniversary was canceled, and everything kind of went to shit very quickly. So that's just the way it is.
And the period itself, kind of like, I guess, with the Dahmer part, we talked about the decor, and it's not like like today that people take their phone and take pictures of just about anything. Like,
right.
You have general pictures maybe of what the mall or a mall looks like, but you don't really know for sure that it looks exactly this way.
Well, there are a lot of photos of, say, the Kent State campus. So I know exactly what the buildings look like. I know what the grounds look like. I had maps. I had, you know, all that stuff. So, yeah, I was able to recreate it. It was tricky because, the Kent State campus is quite large. And they were building things very quickly back then. It's not like, France, where universities are, 500 years old. I mean, Kent State was basically maybe 60 years old at that time. And so you had to keep things straight, and it was a puzzle, but there was available photo reference. It wasn't that difficult.
Yeah. Easier than in Dahmer, or?
Is what?
Easier than recreation of the period in My Friend Dahmer.
No, it was harder because, Dahmer was very narrow. You know, it was just the high school and this one neighborhood and maybe a few other scenes. Where Kent State was this huge, it was a big college town. It was this big campus. No, Kent State was harder.
And in all of those books, I feel that you kind of put yourself in the periphery of all of your stories. And in Otto and Punk Rock and Mobile Homes, there's a bit of yourself in him, and in all the scene in Trashed, well, it's based at first on your experience. So it's kind of like your avatar kind of there in a way, in part. In My Friend Dahmer, you're a secondary character to the story. And then there's the young Derf in the first 10 pages of Kent State. So you're always around your stories, but
yeah,
never
I'm
the
lurking
main character.
Around. I'm lurking around. But, Kent State, that was not my generation. That was not my experience, yeah. I came of age a decade later. And, by 1980, the world had completely changed. So I had no experience with the war. I had no experience with, living in terror of being drafted and sent off to the jungle or any of that stuff. That just was not my experience. So I had to come to the story and learn about those things and talk to people who did experience that to get some understanding of what they went through. So it was a little different with Kent State.
It changed a bit from the other ones where you were more talking about a past that you knew more vividly in a way.
Right, exactly.
And for Dahmer, I guess the what's interesting in that one, if we focus a bit on it, is the duplication, the parts that were with Jeff Dahmer himself that are a bit dark, because we all know we see what's happening, we all know what's going to happen also. And the part with you and your friends with the Dahmer fan club, it's more like there's the levity, there's a bit of more fun. So kind of the tale of two stories also in that.
Yeah,
one.
Very much so. I think that makes it scarier.
Yeah.
Contrast is a very effective storytelling device. And I use contrast a lot. I use it in Trashed as well. And with Dahmer, you see these kids, my friends and myself, who are just living normal lives and being idiots, as most teenage boys are. And then you see Jeff, who is doing something very, very different. And it just gets stranger and stranger, and he gets farther and farther away from them. I think that's very effective. It's also, when a reader looks at a book, there has to be something there that they can relate to, that they can, it really ties them to the story. And Jeff is just, he becomes less and less human as the book goes along, and he's really not sympathetic, and he's not something that anyone could look at and say, oh, wow, yeah, I know exactly what he's thinking, because nobody knows what, nobody experienced that.
Yeah.
So you have these four other kids who are very typical, very normal. And that gives you some humanity in the book that you can, you know, kind of hang on to. So that was my thinking when I wrote it that way.
Yeah, I guess so, because we can put ourselves in their shoes and see this guy that's a bit dangerous, that's a bit weird. And like they're bored, they don't know what to do of their time, and they decide to like, okay, tag along, come, and he's there. And eventually it's a bit gets too dangerous and they try to like just go distance themselves from him.
Right. Exactly. That's the story. You've given it all away.
For those who haven't read it yet. they should, though. They should. And I guess to find this equilibrium also between the two parts, between we talked a bit about the fact that you tried quite a bit to write it in different parts of your life. So I guess eventually you managed to found a way to tell it that fit your vision, that you managed to go and say, okay, that's it. I've got it.
That point. Yeah, that was it. Yeah. I couldn't have done that book if I hadn't done Punk Rock and Mobile Homes first. That's the book that really that was my breakthrough. You know, it's like, this is how you do it. And so then I was able to sit down and write Mon Ami Dahmer. And I wrote it very quickly because, you know, I've been thinking about it for so long at that point. It just, that was another book I wrote in just maybe a couple weeks. Yeah. And when I wrote it, then I was like, yeah, this is what I was looking for. And then I had to draw it. And that was, you know, another bit of a little more complicated. But once I wrote it, I knew I was on the right track.
Yeah, and because of all the works that you did before, the tries and the documentation, mm-hmm. I guess also. And I guess at times documenting this kind of stuff must have been quite eerie. I read somewhere that you actually found that you and your friends were around when he killed Stephen Hicks, which is main point of the crescendo of the book. So
right, that was his first victim. Yeah, a young hitchhiker he picked up at the edge of our hometown. With Dahmer. It's surreal is the best way to describe it. And it has been for so many years that now when something surreal happens, like I was watching a TV show the other day and they made a Jeffrey Dahmer joke. It was just streaming it on Netflix. And I was like, you know, you think about it. All right, here I am watching a TV show and they're making fun of a kid that I sat next to at lunch. It's, you know, you just kind of laugh, but it's just one of a thousand surreal things that happen. So, you know, one after another, I don't really even notice it anymore, but yeah, at times at first it was very, very troubling. It was hard to deal with. It took me a while, a couple years.
You didn't need to distance yourself enough from the events to be able to write about them.
Well, you know, it was kind of a weird psychological defense. And my friends, I talked to them and my friends did the same thing. You know, when he was captured, when he was caught finally in 1991, that was, you know, like 13 years after high school. So it was still pretty fresh. And just like that, you know, our entire personal history changed. All those memories, all those experiences. They were all redefined by Dahmer, because you realize, holy shit, that's what he was thinking when we were doing this stuff? How creepy, you know? And he was planning his murder and he was hiding the body and holy shit, you know, I dropped him off and the body was in the car and God, it was just one thing after another. And that's a very, that's hard to deal with when that happens, you know? I mean, just put yourself in my shoes, that suddenly your entire teenage history had been completely rewritten in just a snap of a finger. But the defense mechanism we all adopted was, okay, we have that, but we also have our original memories. It's like we have two timelines almost. And the original memories are the same silly memories that everybody has about high school and their teenage years. And then we have these new memories, that same thing with all these creepy elements. And I can bounce back and forth between the two timelines and it doesn't, it's very automatic. So that's how I dealt with that. It it's kind of unusual, and all my friends did as well.
Yeah, and I guess it's kind of how we see the book in a way also, because we can see it as a, without the elements of them, or just the happy memories and stuff like right. We did as a kid that you do, and that I did something similar. I guess everybody did something
right, sure. similar. Well, it's getting back to what we talked about. Yeah. You have to give people something they can relate to. And I think that makes it the normality of those scenes makes the book creepier, because you see the Dahmer is just kind of wandering through this normal setting and doing what he did, which was monstrous.
Yeah, and I guess you can see these scenes as the first kind of memories, or the second part, the ones that you discovered in 1994.
Right.
So with the looming part around right. it, because you can do it the second way with the knowledge of what happened after.
Well, you get that in the narration.
Yeah,
that's where you get that second, the later knowledge. And in the actual scenes and the dialogue, that's original. That's from, that's from high school. That's a lot of stuff I pulled out of my journals at the time. I kept journals in high school. So, I had, what I was thinking and the way I talked, it was all there written down. So that's the actual book. And then the narration is the creepy part. That's the... the narrator knows what happened. So yeah, you get that contrast again. Another example of contrast.
Yeah, and so it's kind of I guess needed in a way for that one. For Trash also, we said, because it gives weight and additional perspective. And
right.
I guess each book you need to find the way to best tell to bring us to your mind state of mind in a way.
Right. Right. Yeah, Trash doesn't have narration through the whole thing, but it's a lot like Kent State. You've got, when you break away from the story to talk about something else, then you've got narration. And so I kind of wrote them the same way. But the story itself, in both cases, it's just conversation and what's happening. It's not necessarily narration. And punk rock doesn't have it at all, so that's nice.
And you think that this kind of approach comes a bit naturally because of your journalistic experience, that you kind of like when tackling real life subjects that you set them up in that way to get this kind of equilibrium.
I think I included the narration because I thought it was necessary to tell the story. And that's really the important thing.
Yeah.
What do I need to do to tell this story effectively? And that's why I included it in Trashed, and that's why I included it in Kent State. Yeah. And the narration in My Friend Dahmer is completely different, because that's a person, that's my voice. Mm-hmm. That's my voice as an adult. So it's, it's memoir. In Trashed and in Kent State, it's an objective statement of facts and figures and things like that. It's not memoir. So they're very different. I'll do what I have to do to tell the story. That's the simple answer.
Yeah, and in Trash, it's needed because the parts where you give factual information that
right.
we need to know, it's subjective. It's not the characters
right.
talking. And in
right.
Kent State, it's that even more, because we need to set you as an objective journalist and author
right.
Of all this situation. So
well, that's why Kent State has 25 pages of footnotes in the back. If somebody wants to read them, I don't know if anyone's going to read them, but it's every scene, If you wonder, well, where did he get that? Well, you turn to the footnote, and right there, it'll tell you where I got that. So, yeah, it was a lot of work.
I guess it must be pretty hard feeling in a way that knowing that your book is there in warehouses, waiting to be released, 4 years of your life, and that we don't really know what will happen this fall, and how will the public be there in the same way. So it puts you in a kind of a hard place in a way.
Yeah, it's horrible. Yeah, but every spring book is pretty much screwed. So hopefully by the fall, it'll be a little better. I don't know if it will be here. As far as the pandemic goes, I mean, it's kind of a disaster here, as you know. Europe seems to be a little better. You're slowly starting to open up again. Yeah, there's really no way to know. I mean, you know, this is just the way it is. This is the hand I've been dealt. So, you know.
I hope
Kent State will, you know, hopefully, even if it doesn't have a book launch as it should have, people will find the book eventually, hopefully. I mean, you know, it'll be one that builds slowly, maybe.
As we said in the interview, it's still a pretty relevant book as far as events right now are concerned. And I hope that it's going to find its public because from what I've read it, and it's a good read. It's a necessary read. It's pretty great.
Thank you. Yeah, I figure I got like another 6 weeks, and then, you know, I'll start giving interviews and the book will start leaking out and reviews will start coming in. So 6 weeks, hopefully, you know, some soldiers don't open fire on a bunch of protesters between now and then. I mean, it sounds horrible to say that, but, you know, those kind of petty concerns that an author has. But yeah, I wish it had been out in April. You know, what can you do?
So as we talked a bit about the books, et je vais les rappeler, I'm going to tell them a bit just to close the interview. So dans le fond, on peut retrouver les livres de Derf Back Derf. Donc, on a parlé de 4 ouvrages, Punk Rock and Mobile Homes, Mon ami Damar, Trashed et Kent State, 4 morts dans l'Ohio. Les 4 livres du côté francophone donc sont du côté des éditions Ça et Là. Et la version française de Kent State va arriver elle aussi en cours d'année. Aussi du côté des éditions Ça et Là, et évidemment les versions anglaises qui sont également pour la plupart disponibles. And Derf Back Derf, we usually do the last 5 questions of the interview are standard in the, these meetings. So the first one is, I'd like to know the first, it's, I'm going to say comic book, but it's comic book, comic strip, graphic novel, it can be what you want. And the first comic that you read?
You know, it was probably Peanuts when I was a little kid, probably 4 or 5 years old, because these were newspaper strips, and you know, every day it would come into my house. There'd be the paper, and there'd be comics, and so I tried to figure those out. And it was a great strip, and you know, when I was a little kid, before this was really the peak of it. So that's probably the first one I read. The first one that really, you know, really kind of astounded me. I was like, pick it up. I'm like, holy shit, this is great. That would be, of course, Mad Magazine.
The one that you're reading in Kent State, actually.
Right. And especially, exactly, yeah, good memory. Especially these original reprints of the first issues, which was Harvey Kurtzman and Wally Wood and all these really great guys. That was a mind blower. And I think every comics author, every American comics author and Canadian comics author of like 40 years period there started with Mad Magazine. So that was my big breakthrough.
The comic that you read and read again the most?
I don't know that there is one, because I stopped reading comics when I started making comics. So I really don't read that many comics anymore, and haven't for years and years and years. I just needed to clear my mind. You know, I couldn't have other people's comics in my head. So I'll see them, I look at them, you know, but once I got to be about 20 years old, I stopped reading comics. So I don't really read something over and over again.
Yeah. So I guess also the last comic book you've read is like a while ago.
The old stuff I still read, like, for fun. This is one I read for fun this summer, Crazy Cat. These are the daily strips, which have not been collected. So this is the complete year, 1934. This is the only year that's been collected. Now that we know the big Sunday strips, right? But these are the little daily strips, and they're pretty crazy and amazing and very strange. So I've been enjoying that. And the other thing I've been reading, I've gotten a lot of these, you know, these artist editions. These are reproductions of the original art. So I've got like four or five of these that I've gotten, and you can study them. I mean, you know, you can just look and see how the mistakes are there, you know, the corrections are there, and it's all, you can see how these pages came together. Here's another one that's really great. This is Barry Smith's Conan. Yeah. And whoops, these are all from the 70s. So these are books that I read when I was a teenager. And you can just see how he does the ink work and how he does like textures and things like, so it's really almost homework, you know. And I've been enjoying those. So that's how I read comics now. You know, I'm like looking at them and seeing how a master does different things on the page. And it's not something I read for pleasure anymore. It's something I read, you know, I study.
And from these books that you study now and that you used to read before, which one would you say influenced you the most, either personally or professionally? I leave you the choice.
Well, it would probably be Spain Rodriguez. You know Spain?
No, I don't know.
He's one of the original underground cartoonists, Zap Comics. And, I mean, you look at that, and you see that kind of very heavy inked, very punk rock type of look to it. I mean, this looks like punk rock and Trailer Parks, and because that, he was such an influence on me. And so Spain is someone who really, really stuck with me. And I don't know if he's been translated, honestly, into French. I can't tell you. I'd be surprised if he wasn't, but maybe it's not very well known. But I highly recommend his work.
And outside of comics, a book that you particularly liked?
You know, one of the books that had a really lasting impact on me, and I thought, I want to do something like this, is it's a book called Confederacy of the Dunces by John Kennedy Toole. Do you know this book?
My name, I guess.
Confederacy of the Dunces. I have no idea how you'd say that in French. But highly recommend it. He wrote two books. This was the only one that was published during his lifetime. He kept trying to sell the book over 10 years, couldn't sell it, and he was having some mental problems, and he killed himself. And then his mother sold the book to a publisher, and it became this huge classic that won a Pulitzer Prize and all these awards, and we only have the one book. That's the tragedy of it. But it's just hilarious, just such a funny comedy with great characters. Its main character is kind of like, you know, he's a great character in the way that Otto is a great character in my book. And, you know, I was fascinated by that and thought, if you really come up with a great character like that, as we were talking about earlier, it's a lot easier to write with that character. And that's what inspired me to try to come up with Otto. So that's a book that still is very important to me.
Well, Derf, Bagderf, thank you very much for
your
time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Merci.
Ciao.
Eh bien, voilà. Donc, c'est ce qui conclut cette rencontre du 9e type. Je le rappelle peut-être d'entrée de jeu, on avait mentionné, je le rementionne, donc pause estivale qui s'en vient. On va se retrouver en septembre. Donc, pause à la fois pour cette série, à la fois pour l'émission La vie en BD. Alors, évidemment, ce sera un plaisir de vous retrouver en septembre prochain. Et d'ici là, ben, je remercie évidemment les partenaires de cette série. Alors, évidemment, La vie en BD sur CKRL 89.1, évidemment, Québec BD, ainsi que La Fabrique culturelle. Un merci tout particulier à Thomas-Louis Côté, qui assure la partie technique de ces rencontres. Alors, ben, merci beaucoup, Thomas-Louis. Et ben, de notre côté, donc, on se dit à très bientôt. Merci d'avoir été à l'écoute et ben, bon été, tout en bande dessinée.